Hello there, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and its region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. If you haven't already, do consider joining Turkey Book Talk as a member. Membership gives you various extra benefits and content, and it also helps us keep the podcast going. If you do sign up as a member, you get access to full transcripts in both Turkish and English of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. You'll also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, mostly in English, which amounts to over 60 conversations so far. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hürriyet Daily News, but from now on, a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. And that archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. As a member, you also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles, and they've kindly made over 200 books from their Turkey and Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past, and there'll be more in the future, so becoming a member is obviously a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll be helping us develop the podcast, and if more people join, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a Turkey Book Talk member, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. At present, we post new episodes bi-weekly, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then everything helps and you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. So do consider taking advantage of the membership system, and you can find details of how to sign up via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or through any of the other Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Volkan Yilmaz. He's an assistant professor of social policy and the director of the Social Policy Forum Research Center at Istanbul's Boğaziçi University. He's also the author of The Politics of Healthcare in Turkey, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. The book is a detailed study of an important but often overlooked aspect of contemporary Turkish political life. A revolution in the country's healthcare system is among the things that the ruling Justice and Development Party trumpets doing over its 15 years in office. It may not get much attention abroad, but revamping the healthcare system since 2002 is always near the top of the party's pitch to voters. According to that official line, the system in the old Turkey was chaotic, limited, and ineffective, while healthcare in the new Turkey is fairer, more comprehensive, and more efficient, and generally everything's just fantastic. In this conversation, Volkan Yilmaz talks about the details of the reforms, what changed from the old system, what got better, what got worse, who gained, and who lost. The reforms are often described as classically neoliberal, expanding the role of the market in healthcare provision, but as the book shows, the reality is rather more complicated. Apologies for the slightly jumpy quality of the recording right at the start. Don't worry, it does improve after the first couple of minutes. I started by asking Volkan Yilmaz to outline the traditional shape of the Turkish healthcare system in the decades before the AKP came to power in 2002.
Healthcare system before the reform was aspiringly a universalistic healthcare system, but at the same time it failed to provide universal access. It was mainly because of the fact that Turkish health based on social health insurance. Various continental European countries also implemented social health insurance as the main financing model for their healthcare systems. But in the Turkish case, the problem was Turkey could not really provide formal sector jobs for all. So because the access was determined on the basis of your payment of premiums when you work in a formal sector job, for those who couldn't have the chance to get a formal job, or for those, for example, who didn't have a relative which are working for the formal sector, could not really benefit. So what Justice and Development Party did in the 2002 elections was to appeal to people who suffered from being outside further to the system. In 1992, there was one policy attempt by the Demirel government at the time to provide a tax-funded kind of healthcare insurance for the very poor. And that basically provided the poor access to inpatient services in public hospitals. But still, people do need to go to outpatient services as well, and people were not happy with their unequal position in accessing healthcare services. So there was this occupational status-based inequality between among citizens in accessing healthcare services. And what AK Party promised is to equalize all. And after the reform, they really equalized people's access to public healthcare services. So reform, in that sense, delivered its promise. But at the same time, what the reform did was a very interesting combination of promise of equality in access and integration of private actors into the provision of healthcare services, which is an unholy alliance in a way. Because normally, if you have private sector actors becoming dominant in the healthcare system, you will start witnessing income-based inequalities this time in accessing healthcare services. So if the reform's main promise is equality, then how are you going to equalize people in a marketplace? That was one of the paradoxes of the reform that I'm digging into in the book.
I wonder if you could just kind of dig a bit more, like you say there, really these reforms opened up the private sector's introduction into the healthcare system in Turkey. Really, you know, like one of the labels that gets thrown around really is the idea that the AKP is, you know, neoliberal, in quotation marks. And as your book describes, really, that's a little bit oversimplistic because in the healthcare example, the reality is a lot more complicated. You see, there's a considerable amount of privatization and private sector encouragement. But also there's this kind of general opening out of health insurance coverage to people who weren't covered before. So there's this kind of bringing people into the net. I don't know, it's not the kind of thing that you would expect, let's say, from a more privatized health insurance system. I wonder if you could just kind of reflect a bit on this paradox.
The Turkish healthcare reform included both expansion of access, welfare expansion, which we can see by looking at, for example, public health expenditures for healthcare. So public health expenditures and the role of public sector in total health expenditures increased after the reform. But at the same time, I don't think that we can just call or identify the reform as welfare expansionism, because in the medium term, we will see the negative implications of integration of the private actors into provision. For example, now with your general health insurance as a citizen of Turkey, you can apply to private sector providers, but you have to top up your public health insurance by an out-of-pocket payment. And at the same time, the Ministry of Health categorizes private hospitals according to the quality of services they provide. And the level of out-of-pocket payment increases when the quality of hospital that you would like to go increases, which means if you really want to get better quality healthcare services, you have to pay more. Of course, you have the public option still that makes it better than a healthcare system without a public option. But what I'm trying to emphasize is the fact that still there is this income-based inequalities which is introduced by the reform. That's why I think it is partly a neoliberal reform, but it's not a neoliberal reform that has been characterized in the scholarship so far. But while public role in total health expenditure increases, we also see that a significant component of this increase goes to the private providers. So it's in a way an incentive for private providers to invest more in healthcare provision. So it's welfare expansionism, but at the same time, market expansionism. I think it has been a win-win strategy for the first 10 years of the reform, but the complications that this paradox will manifest themselves in near future, and it started to manifest itself in the future. For example, there is this one hotline organized by the Ministry of Health for patients to file complaints. So today, majority of complaints is about the level of out-of-pocket payments for private providers. So people started to to understand the fact that even though they have been equalized among each other in terms of their occupational statuses, now they have another problem in accessing healthcare, which is the requirement to pay for the quality. So that's why I think still the reform can be categorized as neoliberal, but neoliberal is such an ambiguous term now, and there are degrees of neoliberalism. I don't think that the Turkish reform is a textbook case for neoliberalism. It's a very complicated reform which includes neoliberal components, let's say.
And obviously the other danger with the term neoliberal is that it's always used really by its critics, and like the AKP wouldn't come out and say, yes, we're neoliberal, or these reforms are neoliberal reforms, you know. They use other terms, you know, they talk about how, you know, they're bringing people into the tent, and part of the reason they can do that is because really the public has responded very positively to these changes in the years after the reform started. You quote in the book some figures from the official Turkish Statistics Agency where citizens who said that they're satisfied or highly satisfied with the country's healthcare system increased from 40% in 2003 to around 75% in 2013. There was this big shift upwards, and it really does kind of emphasize in a way this sense that healthcare reform and healthcare progress and an expanding of healthcare coverage is seen as being a big asset for the AKP government.
That's correct. The level of satisfaction with healthcare services increased dramatically with the reform. But we have to be cautious in understanding this satisfaction. I mean, we don't have any data on which part of the reform that people are satisfied with and why people are started to complain about the healthcare system now. Because the reform had this paradoxical nature, I think the short-term gains were the factors that satisfied the public with the new system. But it's becoming much more apparent for people now that the reform is also about introducing contributory payments, different kinds of formal out-of-pocket payments that people were not really paying before. And the level of those payments are increasing over time. In addition to this is the fact that when you introduce private providers, you also introduce a new actor in the health politics scene, which is underestimated by the government, I think. Because the government thought, and many of my informants from the Ministry of Health told me that the state is able to regulate the private sector and make it work for the good of the general public, which is partly true. Because when you create a new market, you create a new set of actors. So we have, for example, now almost one-fourth of all bed capacity in the country belongs to the private sector. And this economic power translates into political power too. For example, there are like a number of private sector lobby organizations which are asking the government to increase levels of contributory payments from the patients, and the government is under pressure of this private sector lobby now, which wasn't the case before the reform. And this private sector lobby is increasing in political power by integrating into international actors too, which are again pressuring the government to increase contributory payments. And this pressure will be an ongoing pressure. So we now have a new strong political actor, the impact of which will increase privatization and will be at the expense of the patient's interests in the future. That's one of the challenges that the reform has created, I think.
You mentioned there this kind of political aspect, and one of the things that has been reported in the last few years as well, obviously we're not talking here about an economic relationship, but there's been a few reports about how various tarikats are really entering the healthcare system in Turkey, and particularly the Menzil Tarikat, religious brotherhood, religious group that is kind of using their contacts in the AKP to kind of get their associates' positions in the healthcare sector. I just wonder if you could kind of reflect a bit on this. It's not an economic aspect of these reforms, but it's something that's very important when it comes to the AKP's healthcare system policies in recent years, at least.
One of the members of the parliament from the AK Party publicly declared that some religious brotherhoods have been organized within different ministries. But I would consider that a continuation of a political culture which has been there before the AK Party. I mean, setting up one's own cadre in public offices has always been part of the Turkish political culture. So if that happened in this period, I wouldn't see it as a rupture from the old practices, but it is basically a continuation of the past practices of previous governments. But the problem with that, this setting up your own cadre in public offices undermines meritocratic structure of public offices, which is quite problematic in my view. I mean, you need to have well-educated bureaucrats in your Ministry of Health and in all other ministries if you really would like to catch up with the international policy trends and creating, again, well-educated responses to the challenges that various healthcare systems are facing, including Turkey. So I wouldn't say that that's an important feature of the Turkish healthcare reform, but it is a continuity of the political culture which works against public interest, I think.
And one of the other things that the book does is you kind of talk a bit about how, you know, the reforms were very much welcomed in the public, really, speaking mm-hmm. generally. But there was also there has been quite a lot of resistance from various healthcare sector unions and doctors mm-hmm. unions, other groups who mm-hmm. are working longer hours, who are not receiving the kind of money that they may have been before. Just wonder if you could talk about this aspect as well. Like the kind of effects of these reforms on workers in the sector.
On that issue, I'd like to talk a little bit about Turkish Medical Association. Turkish Medical Association is a standard medical association that you can find in every country. But at the same time, its political understanding of healthcare is very different. For example, Turkish Medical Association does not accept any sponsorships, funds from the private sector, including pharmaceutical sector, including private healthcare providers, which is not the case for many medical chambers in different countries. And when I talked to my informants from Turkish Medical Association, they were always underlining the peculiarity of Turkish Medical Association in trying to come up with a holistic understanding of right to health, which does not only include interests of the medical profession, but also include interests of the patients in general. So they are trying to, in a way, reconcile patients' interests and medical professions' interests, which is very interesting because of, again, the specificity of the Turkish political culture, because Turkish Medical Association has been governed by a group of left-wingers since late 1970s. It had a different political standpoint on healthcare issue. It can be comparable to British Medical Association politically. So because of this perspective, Turkish Medical Association has been an opponent since the beginning of the reform. It was against the integration of private sector hospitals into the system. It was against introduction of out-of-pocket payments, etc., etc. So it was the actor which called the reform a neoliberal reform, by the way, in the Turkish debates. So there is this political tension between the leading cadre of Turkish Medical Association and the government, which is an ongoing conflict. If you follow what is happening with respect to the current debates on Turkish operations in Syria, the conflict is not limited to healthcare issues. It includes various political issues which are topical today.
Yes, so, the Turkish Medical Association recently was in the headlines because at the start of this Afrin operation, they released a statement and it was seen as being an anti-war statement, and it became this kind kind of notorious case that, you know, the government, Erdogan then came out and completely slammed them. They really came under a lot of fire, and it looked very, very nasty for a while. It was only a couple of months ago, but it seems like a long time ago now. But they do often come, like, they do, the Turkish Medical Association does pop up every now and then as being this kind of voice of opposition in a way. I remember they were there in the Gezi protests as well, you know, making statements. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know if it seems strange, particularly when you think about the Afrin thing, you know, that there's been almost no public voices against against these policies. So they almost seem like a kind of outlier now.
Exactly. Even during the first years of the reform, Turkish Medical Association was almost alone in criticizing the reform. It's very interesting to see that, because there are opposition parties. there were opposition parties which had the duty to review the reform and come up with appraisals as well as criticisms. But Turkish Medical Association was quite alone during its campaign against the reform. So because of these criticisms and its different take on healthcare issues, Turkish Medical Association was excluded from the policy process by the government. Probably you know, there's one chapter on the relationship between the World Bank and the government during the reform process. So the World Bank was also part of the reform process. And when I talked to representatives of the World Bank at the time, they were also telling me that the reform was quite a closed process. It was designed in a very technocratic way. So this reform being a closed process, meaning the exclusion of the representatives of the medical doctors having a say on the main components of the reform and the direction of the Turkish healthcare system after the reform, etc. So this exclusion of Turkish Medical Association made the reform much more fragile in a way, because even though the reform created legitimacy among the general public, medical doctors are, at least the majority, let's say, of the medical doctors have not been convinced with the reform, and they weren't represented in the process. So what the reform did is to ease access, as we talked before. Easing of access without increasing the number of medical doctors means increasing workloads for medical doctors in public hospitals. The government tried to compensate for this increased workload by introducing a performance pay scheme. So now medical doctors have their baseline salaries, which are topped up with performance payments. And this idea of performance payments is an idea which originated from new public management reforms, which appeared first in the UK. It tries to integrate private sector management techniques into public sector institutions. And generally, it creates efficiency. You push public servants to serve more people at a limited time. But medical doctors are criticizing the reform by lowering the quality of healthcare services that they provide, because they have very limited time for each patient. They have this maximum amount of time that they can allocate for a patient, and basically their salaries depend on their performance. So Turkish Medical Association was voicing the criticism of this lowering quality and the undermining of trust between patients and medical doctors, because patients now know that medical doctors get more money if they see more patients at a limited time. This is, I think this is very important, even though I don't think that there is an easy solution to this conflict between the government's approach to increasing access and medical doctors' emphasis on the quality of services. I think it's a dilemma, and it's not an easy dilemma to solve. But still, we need the voices of medical doctors to at least see the impact of this increasing access on the quality of healthcare services. And it's not included in today's debates on healthcare system. Everybody talks about increasing access and how it satisfied people. But if medical doctors think that quality is not good anymore, if they think that it's impossible for medical doctors to practice as they wish to practice for the benefit of the patient, then there is a problem we have to look into.
But of course, the kind of public has responded positively, and it is generally seen as a kind of success for the mm-hmm. AKP. And I, as I was reading the book, it's something I kind of reflected on, really. Like, you know, a subject like healthcare often gets overlooked. The potency of healthcare reforms or mm-hmm. success in healthcare policies is often kind of overlooked by people in Turkey and abroad. And you know, even in Turkey, politics is really almost always, you know, about nationalism and, you know, mm-hmm. accusing people of being traitors and crazy conspiracy theories and all that. But I often think those crazy aspects wouldn't work as well in the government's favour if there wasn't this kind of material development underpinning everything, you know. Mm-hmm. So things like healthcare reform, you know, they really do serve this absolutely crucial base, really, underpinning all the more crazy stuff that goes on the surface of mm-hmm. politics mm-hmm. in Turkey.
I don't think that healthcare reform is still part of the political debate. As you mentioned, today Turkish politics is dominated by this polarized atmosphere between political actors, especially the government, accusing all those in opposition as being traitors, and the opposition is doing a very similar thing as well. That's one of the reasons, I think, healthcare policy is not discussed today. And because this nationalist rhetoric silences all other issues which are of crucial importance to everyday lives of people. And I'm afraid that this de-democratization process will have a negative impact on the direction of the reform, because basically one of the reasons why AK Party had a promise of equality in access to healthcare was to gain more votes, and that was logical, that was an expected behavior from a political party which aims to stay in power in an electoral democracy. But if there is no electoral competition, and then you don't really have to listen to the grievances of people if you're not competing with any other political party. So that's why I think democracy is key to keep the positive gains of the reform intact. Because if there is no electoral competition, then the government most probably would be listening to the private sector lobby organizations only. And these actors and their impact on healthcare system will increase. And this increase will be at the expense of patients' rights in the future.
I don't know, you know, like, that's an interesting line to take, but in a way, like, you could look at it in another way by thinking an authoritarian government is almost more sensitive to changes in public opinion because it's really paranoid about people turning against it. So it's constantly, you know, the AKP still monitors public opinion, like, obsessively and makes changes accordingly. And I think you see it in some other countries as well where, you know, you've got an anti-democratic or an undemocratic government in place and they're actually paradoxically kind of more receptive in a way to like raw public mm-hmm. opinion, because they're kind of worried that if public opinion gets out of control, there's no outlet democratically for people to voice their frustrations. So it's mm-hmm. even more dangerous for a government in mm-hmm. that kind of circumstance. I don't know, in Turkey, maybe that dynamic will happen going forward, or maybe, as you say, it will be the opposite.
Especially in the case of healthcare, I would expect the opposite, because in healthcare there is this very influential health economist, basically the founder of health economics discipline, Kenneth Arrow, who wrote the following. In healthcare markets, there's this information asymmetry between medical doctors and the patients, because patients do not know what happened to them, and they cannot really choose among different options because they don't know the effectiveness of different treatments for their illnesses. So in healthcare markets, the seller knows everything. And so the buyer, the customer, is very weak. So it's not easy for the general public to form an opinion on healthcare policy. You need opposition parties introducing alternative ideas so that people start to make sense of their grievances in a way. Otherwise, for example, Turkish public started to get accustomed to pay for healthcare after the reform. And most probably, there are more people now who thinks that it's normal for the rich to get better quality healthcare services than the poor because they have more money and they have the ability to pay more for the healthcare services. But there was one survey which was conducted in early 2000s where they found that Turkish public overwhelmingly supports the dominant role of the public sector in providing services because this is one of the areas where they expect equality. You don't expect equality in buying houses, for example. But historically, and when you look at the political culture of the country, healthcare has been one of the domains where people think that it is the duty of the government to provide healthcare services, and it should be distributed according to need rather than according to ability to pay, willingness to pay, etc. But the reform normalizes a new culture. And if you don't have rival political actors, I don't think that the public opinion can work against the normal operation of the healthcare system now. I mean, even though people can complain about some bits of the reform, I wouldn't expect a bottom-up framing of the new system and coming up with a new public alternative or whatever. So you need rival political actors to do this. That's why we need political parties anyway. So that's why I think if there is no electoral competition, then you don't have any alternatives to what is already existing. So even though the AK Party might be closely following the public opinion, it wouldn't find a significant criticism which will require the government to change the direction of the healthcare system. The healthcare system will continue like this, and the only party that will make its case will be the private sector, I think. And the other thing, because of the polarization and the terms of the polarization too, the healthcare policy will not make it to the political agenda in this atmosphere. I mean, people are not voting on the basis of how they see AK Party's new social policies, etc. I mean, the polarization, the terms of the polarization, as you mentioned, is on the threats to the unity of the republic, nationalism, and this war atmosphere. I mean, there is this security issues which are dominating the political agenda, which leaves no room for social policy issues to influence the voting behavior anymore. That's another reason why I wouldn't expect the government to take steps to protect patients' interests in the long term.
And just to conclude, I think while we're talking here about healthcare in Turkey, one of the issues that's become important, I think, in recent weeks, there's been this realization that there's this rising anti-vaccination phenomenon going on in Turkey. Mm-hmm. Every year there's a kind of rise, there's a rising tide of people who are against vaccinations of various kinds. And particularly recently, this guy's Soner Yalçın, he's a kind of conspiracy theorist, rather unpleasant character, really. And he's written this book that's full of these conspiracy theories about vaccinations and how it's a terrible plot, and it's really potentially very, very dangerous, I think, going forward. I just wonder if you think that could be a serious problem in Turkey in the years ahead, this anti-vaccination tide.
I think it's because of the spirit of post-truth in the world in general. Trust of people in the medical knowledge has been undermined. For example, there is this also another debate on alternative medicine, and alternative medicine has been integrated into the Turkish healthcare system recently. I think we need to stick to the scientific criteria which makes different kinds of medications, vaccinations, reliable, and we shouldn't really equate alternative medicine with medicine, because I mean, the medicine carries with it the scientific evidence backing the positive implications for patients, etc. And in the case of vaccination, it's even worse, because you need to vaccinate the whole population to get rid of communicable diseases. So it's even though it's been framed as if it's like an individual choice issue, it's not an individual choice issue. I mean, communicable diseases, getting rid of communicable diseases diseases is a public effort. So if a vaccine is found to be effective in preventing a communicable disease to spread, it shouldn't be treated as an individual choice issue, because it one person who is not vaccinated affects the general population's health in the future. So this anti-vaccination campaign, I would say, is very depressing. And this interplay between this anti-vaccination campaign and nationalism, as you mentioned, is also very interesting. Many similar stories that I heard from various Arab countries. I heard in one of the academic conferences, I heard an Egyptian scholar framing vaccination campaigns as imperialist interventions into the Egyptian society. It's really very depressing to see that very anti-science, anti-modernity, anti-enlightenment sensibility among even among scholars. There is no scientific debate on the efficacy of vaccinations. Basically, it's one of the revolutions that we had in the history of humanity. This public health revolution was due to the vaccination and sanitation, which saved a lot of lives, and it's one of the reasons why the length of human life has increased significantly since the 19th century. So that's why I think, I really feel angry when I hear about these anti-vaccination arguments, because I think the biggest challenge is to provide enough vaccinations for the whole world to get rid of communicable diseases that we can prevent, and we have the means to prevent, and still we couldn't make world society to benefit enough from these vaccinations and their benefits.
That was Volkan Yılmaz. Many thanks to him. Remember to consider joining the Turkey Book Talk membership system. The deal is not bad value at all. If you pledge a minimum $3 per episode, you get access to transcripts in both English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, and also exclusive access to a special 30% discount on a selection of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. You'll be helping Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. You can find links with information on how to sign up on all the Turkey Book Talk websites. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can also follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. I also want to give a little heads up here to some friends of the podcast, particularly of note to listeners here in Istanbul. As part of the Istanbul Tanpınar Literature Festival, which starts on May the 4th. The Bosphorus Review of Books is hosting a panel of Turkish to English translators. Those translators include Zeynep Beler, who has translated Mario Levy and Hakan Günday, Alexander Dor, translator of Sabahattin Ali, Said Faik and Tanpınar's The Time Regulation Institute, and Ümit Hüseyin, who's the translator of Burhan Sönmez and Ayşe Önal. It's a great lineup, and it will all go down on Sunday, May the 6th, at Karg Art in Kadıköy, starting at 6 p.m. It's 20 liras for entry, but that gives you access to all the Karg Art Festival events, so do go along for what should be an excellent evening. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.